Hi, this is Jerry Pippen. We're broadcasting from the Laughlin location. The UFO Congress is here every year, and we have a very, very special person here helping me, Paula Harris. And Paula, we have two very special people that we've been trying to get on the air for some time, and we've been successful today thanks to your help and their generosity.
I think it's very important, Jerry, that we hear this story because the Dan Burrish story is a very, very important story in the disclosure, the slow process release of information that's coming out. And thanks, too, to Marcia McDowell to provide this opportunity for the average citizen to hear Dan talk, because in the end, it's Dan himself that could provide the answers and nobody else. And I thank you very much for having the courage to come forward, Dan, and do the show.
Well, I'm grateful to be here.
It's good to welcome both of you, Dr. Dan Burrish and Marcy McDowell. We will, if it's okay with me, I'll refer to you as Dan and Marcy from now on.
If you please, yes,
please,
thank you.
That would be better.
And it's okay if I refer to you as Paula, right?
That's okay.
And you can call me whatever you want.
I can call you Jerry now.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Jerry.
But remember, we may censor it. Dan and Marcy, let's just start at the beginning here. You were going to college at UNLV and got a contact. I want to get into the education thing later because there's been some controversy there, and we can explain that a little bit, I think.
We can touch on that.
If you'd like to, and we'd certainly like to clarify if we could. But that's not really the important reason we're here. We want to talk about how you got interested. Were you interested in things like this? I believe maybe you were a little bit of UFOs.
Well, no, not so much. I had an unusual experience in 1973 at Mayboyer Park
in California,
yeah. Southern California. Yeah. That would be the Lakewood area of Southern California. Yeah. A very unusual experience that I really had no answers to for many, many years. It was an experience between myself and my grandfather. We were at the park playing baseball, and all of a sudden the grass around me appeared to turn dark, and the next I remember it was several hours later, and I was looking then at my grandfather several meters away, seated at a tree. He was extremely shook up, and from there was a general degraded atmosphere in the domestic atmosphere of my family. I lived in an extended family with my mom, my dad, my grandma, and my grandpa, and very soon thereafter, my grandma and my grandpa, they moved away. And there was great disruptions after this one event. Well, it was kind of put behind me, but I noticed that over the next several years there were, in fact, some changes in my attitudes about things such as science. And
so what we hear about these earth-changing or mind-changing and life-changing experiences actually happened a little bit to you.
Indeed. And in fact, I can disclose a little bit about my personal life here. Following that incident, I remember several occasions where, of course, I was 9 years old at the time, where I would get up in the middle of the night and I would meet my little friend in my house on Steveley Avenue. And I don't have any conscious memory of what my little friend looked like. I remember I called him Harry. And my mom finally convinced me that I was obviously just talking about Oscar the Grouch, because I was still watching Sesame Street, you know, right. Only 9 years old. Certainly there were events going on at the time that I had no particular, real grasp on what had happened to me. Many years later, zooming forward now to post-1994, in the clean sphere, the J-Rod, in fact, informed me that I had been picked up that day at Mayboyer Park.
Yeah, I want to get into the J-Rod story in a little bit here. It's very interesting, Dan and Marcy. Marcy, you two met early on and wrote a book together?
Actually, we met before I wrote the book with Dan. What happened was, after the death of my father, my uncle rather stepped into my life and tried to get me the right education and the right contacts with people, and I ended up being sent to England briefly, and I met Dan at a party in England.
In England?
Yes.
And now you...
Scotland,
and
it was Scotland, but I think of it as England because that's where I ended up going, and then we ended up traveling up, and I met you at this party at Vashti's.
Right. It was at Vashti Bunyan's, the daughter of John Bunyan, the great, great... excelled, the distant removed from John Bunyan, the writer of Pilgrim's Progress. And we had gone up, John and myself had gone up for the weekend to speak with Vashti's husband concerning a Scottish grass sickness issue. And they had a party there, and I rather embarrassed myself when I first took a look at
it. No, please, let me tell it.
Yeah, okay, here's Marcy.
Oh, please, you've
got to
let me
tell it. Here's Marcy's version.
Oh, you've got to
let me
tell it.
No, her version will be the real one.
I mean, I
that's why I would rather interrupt her at this point.
Yes, I know you would. I know you would. I saw this young man at the party, and I looked over at him, and, you know, he was, like, looking at me. I smiled at him. The next thing I know, he's backing up, and he stepped in a silver trash can and fell completely down on his...
I fell backward into her kitchen, yes.
In Vashti's kitchen.
Yes. This is
well,
Vashti Bunyan,
that's a unique singer. Approach.
So I did remember.
I was smooth at 16.
Smooth at 16. So when we finally ran into each other again in the very early 90s, I remembered him because of the trash can incident.
Great.
So now we've got the home record exactly how it happened. Maybe now, Marcy... And Dan, this is really a pleasure having you with you, and I really want to thank Paula for bringing this all together. And Paula, get into this interview and let's talk about a few things.
Well, there's a whole bunch of coincidences I'm seeing here that are not synchronicities. There are synchronicities and coincidences that are, to me, are totally amazing in your story. Knowing each other at an early age, having interaction with an entity when you're young. I mean, somebody orchestrated this thing, Dan. Do you get that feeling that from the beginning somebody orchestrated this thing?
The truth is I get the feeling, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Can I prove it? No.
No.
There were even synchronicities involving the pathologist that took me under his wing when I was very, very young.
Yeah, and we glossed over that a little bit about why you went to England to begin with. And,
I went to England. This started out, I'll digress, back to the pathologist.
Here,
I had been
a child prodigy, I think.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yes.
But.
Okay.
What happened was my mom introduced me to Dr. James Reynolds, who is a pathologist and chief pathologist at Long Beach Memorial Medical Center in Long Beach, California. I began a tutelage under him for a couple years.
Okay, I got to break in. I've got to break in here.
Okay, go ahead.
I do. I have to. You got to understand something here. We're not talking about a young kid who just happened to meet a doctor over at the hospital. No. Dan was beginning to show incredible talent in the field of biology, and it was so marked and so surprising after this incident where he was abducted that his mom was trying desperately to find out how to channel this incredible, you know, this incredible breakthrough of scientific acumen. So she contacted the doctor, the pathology, chief of pathology at Long Beach Memorial Hospital, brought Dan in for a meeting, and he actually was tested and examined by this doctor for knowledge. And this doctor was so impressed that he brought him in as, what were you, 11?
11 at 11, the time, I believe.
11 years old into the Long Beach Memorial Hospital pathology lab to study histopathology directly under Dr. Reynolds. And he worked with him for approximately 2 years until he was so good at what he did that he was introduced to the Los Angeles Microscopical Society.
I was originally introduced to John DeHaas, who was then a professor at the University of Southern California.
Uh-huh.
And he provided my mom and dad with my first professional microscope, which I still have. It's a 1954 Bosch and Lomb.
Now when we talk about all of this, all this background is important because it comes into play when you go to UNLV, and we'll get into the educational thing later, but you ended up getting recruited by the Navy Department?
They were, it was majestic. Okay. I wouldn't really say that it was the Navy Department.
Okay, okay.
They gave me a lot of names. They could have said that they were the Admiral of the Kentucky Navy for, you know, it wouldn't have mattered. It was Majestic who was doing the recruiting. And in fact, it was the Committee of the Majority that was doing the recruiting. I was cutting tissue sections today in Dr. Bert Barbero's laboratory, a parasitologist at the university who I believe went to emeritus status and then retired. And they literally walked into the laboratory, which had been a locked laboratory. They unlocked the door, which was the first surprise to me. So I figured immediately that it was one of the professors who was coming into the lab, and given the sequence of events, I was a little bit nervous that the other professors were coming in, as I had just separated off from a different professor inside the biology department. So they walked in, and I looked around the corner from the small prep laboratory, which separated the histology lab from the actual parasitology lab. That's where I was doing the microtomy. I was doing some sections. I was working just some extra time for him so I could have some lab space cutting some nematode sections for him. And they walked in, and they said, are you Danny Crane? And Of course, I said, that was my legal name, Danny B. Crane. And I indicated, in fact, that I was, and I said, can I help you with something? They said, well, you know, you may be able to. And I noticed that there was uniforms and suits present in the room. I thought I was in trouble. And the reason why I thought I was in trouble is I had just given an interview. I honestly trust the media. But I get it. This many years later, and I still fall over trash cans.
Yeah, you're right.
No smoother after all of those years. I thought I was in trouble because I had given an interview for the Rebel Yell newspaper. Mm-hmm. And the biology department was very upset because I hadn't cleared it with them first. And it was an interview that did not go well. So I figured I was in you know, even deeper trouble with the university. And maybe these were Board of Regents people and they were involved with the university police or whatever. They fairly quickly cleared me up of that misapprehension. And basically asked me whether or not I was interested in a different lifestyle, an opportunity to have unlimited resources, unlimited working conditions, and working off the edge of the pizza, if you will. And now, I was, it was 1986, so that's, 22 at the time?
22.
Who wouldn't say yes?
Yes, right.
Did I know that there was a connection between what they were offering me and years previous? Not a clue in the world. I had no idea what I was getting involved with. I figured that these people, actually, I figured they were military and this may be biological warfare. Enterprise. And at 22, a biology student, having just irritated my department, knowing that I wasn't going to get a committee letter from my department, would I jump on it? You darn right I did.
Well, sure you did. And from that, you had a roller coaster ride, so to speak. You ended up going out to a secret base, mm-hmm. which we know as Area 51 or S4.
Groom Lake.
Can we get into that when we come back? And
sure.
Paula Harris has something to talk to you about that, I'm sure.
Sure. Be happy to.
I'm Jerry Pippin, and we are talking to Dan Burrish and Marcia McDowell. Along with Paula Harris. Don't go away. We'll be right back. It happened almost 60 years ago, but the debate still rages. Did an alien spacecraft crash outside Roswell, New Mexico in 1947? The most concise and complete series ever broadcast on Roswell, direct from Roswell. New programs added weekly. Check it out on the UFO Files on JerryPippin.com.
About 8 or 10 miles
left. This is Jerry Pippin along with Paula Harris, and we are at the UFO Congress in Laughlin, and our guest are Marcia McDowell and Dan Burrish. And as we left the show, we were talking about the fact, Paula, that he signed an agreement with MJ-12. We're going to follow up on MJ-12 in a little bit. Have you had experience with MJ-12 yourself as far as investigating?
Well, not overtly like this, where they announced their MJ-12. But I did do another story, and that's why I'm so interested in the Dan Burge story. I did a story with Dr. Michael Wolf-Cravant, who worked in a similar area. He worked in S4, and I was totally convinced that some of the things that Dan was saying definitely supported Michael's story, and Michael's no longer with us. But, you know, I've had a lot of trouble with that story because it's really hard to verify. And I believe, this is my belief system as a journalist, that everyone should listen to the whole entire story before they make value judgments. So I totally support the fact that Dan is here to speak for himself and other people do not speak for him. It is very hard when we have to speak for the witness. We journalists, we researchers have to speak for you, and then we're the ones that get all the conflicts and so forth. Could discredit us from our jobs and so forth, and I'm really grateful, Dan, that you have come forward. Now, as far as the MJ-12 situation, the fact that it was sanctioned, what you were doing at S4, it was a sanctioned experiment or a sanctioned job, and that it was a positive kind of situation is maybe what we should get into, what the actual operation was.
Well, I, Dan, I understand. How long was it from 22 until you actually showed up out at S4?
My first trip into the Papoose facility was in 1990.
So you had still some education to go, and
indeed, I was tested for a large length of time. And in fact, there was a hiatus nearly immediately after the recruitment, after I went through a few of their training videos and some testing processes, and the training videos had an MAJ across the front of the TV screen, and it was on an angle, and I saw Madge. My only relationship to that is I actually thought that had to do with the Palmolive commercial. Remember, you're soaking in it. Remember old Madge?
Yeah, that goes
I had
backwards.
No idea what it was, and they weren't even telling me. I didn't know for a long period of time exactly even where Papoose was while they were transporting me there. I didn't know what the actual location was. And this was after assessments which occurred at Groom Lake, the popularized
Area 51. Right, we should see the Papoose is Area 51, so because for people that don't know, it's in the Area 51 complex.
It's in the general complex area.
Area 51, okay.
It's in the general complex. It's technically at a different dry lake bed, but it's Groom.
Let's fast forward here to the first time. Did they tell you where you were going the first time you went out there?
Oh, no. For the longest time, I had been tested in what looked like a Winnebago out by the Silver Bowl. They actually parked in the parking lot by the Silver Bowl, and I was being tested inside that Winnebago.
In Las Vegas, right, Marcia?
Right. I had various levels of pathological testing.
Okay.
Yeah, Sam Boyd Silver Bowl.
Yeah, right.
And what they would do is they would flash slides at me, whether they would be normal mammalian or non-mammalian slides, everything from cytopathology to histopathology slides, and see how quickly I could read them. Now, Jim Reynolds had trained me up very well. And, of course, we can digress later, but I had found out, of course, that Jim Reynolds had been trained in his pathology duties, albeit I cannot directly say that the man has worked for any of the same associates, but he was trained for his duties at Wright-Patterson.
The actual thing that is kind of intriguing, the actual thing that's intriguing about this is while we were actually speaking with Dr. Reynolds about 2 years ago, where we had that reunion, he indicated that he had been trained at Wright-Patt, and he had been assigned to Long Beach the very year that Dan was born.
Mm-hmm. True.
So, asked him if he wanted to be a private or a captain.
Is that how they approached him?
Yeah, that was the phrase. He said, "Did you want to be a private or a captain in the service?" And he said, "Well, of course, I want to be a captain." So he was put on a different fast track, as it were.
And when we talk about that, you actually have been seen in Marine Corps uniforms, right, or Navy uniforms?
I was seen in a United States Naval uniform, and I, in fact, went through a short training process, a two-day training process on how to wear the United States uniform. Yes, sir.
And so technically, you had a military connection, even though you don't really consider that. It was more a Magic 12.
I was assigned to various labels, if you will, various titles. Whenever I had the opportunity and the honor to wear the uniform, I tried to do it with the same dignity as the individuals who were around me. And in fact, I had to unfortunately fight in the uniform in 91. That was unanticipated, but yet it happened.
Well, a lot of these things do, but when you went out there the first time, did you go out on the famous airline, the private airline?
Oh no, the first trip was not with Miss Janet. No,
many subsequent trips were.
The first trip was actually out of Nellis Air Force Base.
Okay.
And it was a direct hop out of Nellis Air Force Base into the Groom Lake facility. I was taken from the aircraft at the Groom Lake facility, put into a small buggy, and taken into the Groom complex, where I entered a room and was taken down in an elevator to a very small wet prep lab that contained microscopes, and that's where the training and the testing evaluation continued.
How did you get to the Nellis facility, though?
I was driven there.
You were driven there. Okay, because I think you can't get on the Nellis facility.
No, I was driven there, and the gentleman had the right insignia on the vehicle, and they were saluted in.
You up occasionally. I mean, take you places.
Well, quite frequently.
My mom used to
watch me get picked up outside the apartment. Finally, it got indiscreet enough because they were aware that certain looky-loo ladies who lived in the apartment complex were writing letters to certain newsmen.
Oh, really? We will get into that, because they didn't write me.
Right. So what they ended up doing is they ended up parking down at the end of the street by the Channel 10 TV station.
Yeah,
that's where
they
finally ended up picking me up.
So you showed up there, you still didn't know what your job was going to be, right?
Oh, no, sir. I didn't know for certain what my job was until the end of 1993.
So you were there quite often, and you still didn't...
Quite often.
How did they spring J-Rod on you?
Well, what happened was after I was finally allowed into the Papoose facility and brought through the in-screening process. Now, the in-screening process is something that the public has not heard about. I'm certain that the public hasn't heard about it because they've heard, well, I might be able to walk out of there with this or that type of stable element, and that doesn't happen. You're stripped, you're weighed, and you're actually walked in. This is a positive pressure former biological warfare facility, and this is not, a place where you can walk in. It's not a mom-and-pop filling station.
Gotcha.
You're screened in, and I was brought into the briefing book area, which was not that far from the nurse's office and around the corner from the clerical area. Following being brought in there, I was shown several of the DTIC books. It said DTIC across the front of the book, and they were part of what was called the King Tut training manuals. The King session was actually the operating level that we were operating under for Aquarius J-Rod. We were the second unit that was being brought in, and I had a manual put in front of me which actually indicated to reticulum 4 in the manual, and I was certain at that point that what we had been looking at for the previous couple years was what I was now reading about in the manuals. You see, we had been looking at ways to regress, if you will, or de-differentiate, if we're going to get into the biospeak, cells which have already gone to a terminal differentiation. And we were doing so with experimental chemicals at the time that are just now hitting the fore involving stem cell research, like reversing disubstitution.
So this 15, 16 years ago, and you were working with these things that are just now the cutting edge.
Yes, sir. We were told to attempt, if we could, to strip an exterior cytoplasm off of an extremely small neuron. We didn't know why we were doing it. And in fact, for, like I said, for the first year, maybe 2 years, I thought I was dealing with a chimera that may have been produced by a biowarfare agent. I didn't know. None of us knew. We gradually got together more and more on the trips that we were going up, first to Groom, then the Hop, down to Papoose. And we finally mounted an insurrection, if you will, against the command and said, pardon the speak, but what the hell are we dealing with here?
Uh-huh.
They finally then allowed us one by one to go through a briefing session, and that's where we were actually faced with the fact that we were dealing with something called an extraterrestrial entity.
Had you suspected that something like that was going on before, or you just thought it was biological, huh?
I suspected that it was a possibility because I grew up watching Star Trek like everybody else.
Okay.
But I did not expect that it was a reality. The first time that I saw the J-Rod in the clean sphere when we were brought up in the gallery, it's actually up into the gallery. There's a step up after you go down through the elevator system.
Now, you wore one of those NASA-type suits or something?
Well, I was in a... to go up from past the biocontainment levels, I was in a BCL-2 uniform, a bunny, with a respirator, and then we went into the gallery area where we could remove our respirators after the sealants were locked. And then the clean sphere was... had been raised.
Why does the J-Rod not? He could not live for a very long time in our atmosphere.
Well, it's a dual situation. Given the given the timeline that he was living with, he was used to a different partial pressure of oxygen. If you dealt with a J-Rod who came from an earlier time period, they could live for a longer period of time. But all the way until August 1991, there was actual hyperbaric therapy, which was going on the entity, on the little person. To try to assist him as his natural physiology was promoted or moved along with higher partial pressures of oxygen, of hydrogen. So it got up to approximately 4%, if I'm recalling the partial pressure right, about 4% hydrogen to make him actually feel better. Otherwise, he was in pain. And, of course, they used pain as a...
behavior modification?
That would be the best word for it. They used intumescence by changing
words,
the pressure to get him to a cattle prod, if you will,
to comply,
with the use of pressure for compliance.
Now, you actually developed a good relationship with him, even though at one time he did attack you, I think.
No, it wasn't an attack.
What was that?
You know,
story
I don't.
About?
Okay,
it wasn't
okay.
Can we start at the beginning? Didn't they tell you not to speak to him? Didn't they tell you not to get too close because he could project images in your brain?
We were not told not to get too close. I had to get right up to him to use the pin system on him for the removal of the samples. We were instructed what the protocol of the contact would be and what we were supposed to do after. Now, of course, this is a long series of protocols. Go through the drum systems, plugging the drum systems and into the clean sphere. But we actually... we're supposed to stand to the right after we got through the gantry area into the clean sphere onto the grate, the actual grate that he was standing on, and we were supposed to raise our right hand, and it would be projected next to us a form of a human being. A man's form would be projected, and then there would be a numerological sequence which would be projected to him indicating that we were not there to harm him. Well, this was all garbage, because by the time I was within a few feet of the clean sphere, getting ready to actually be programmed in. I was in bunnies down on the clean sphere level before I was put through the medical and put into the TES, the total encapsulated suit. I would write on the side of the clean sphere using a Mark-a-Lot backwards. Well, I'm dyslexic, so that helped me. I would write the actual injection ports and the codes for it and the locations and the numbers backward on the side of the clean sphere near where he was sitting. And what he would do, nobody knew why, he would lean over and he would look at me and his finger would follow as I was writing on the clean sphere. And he was talking to me all along, right through the clean sphere. Anything within 30, 35 feet, I could hear him fine. In my own voice, but wrong cadence, you know, your own self-talk.
It just wasn't the same pace.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. It was in a broken, a very broken pace, a very unusual syllabic mixture.
But so they can't control if he spoke to you. They can't control the communication because it's telepathic, right?
Not unless they induce pain.
No.
I don't know. They may have, Sigma was working for years on methods to intercept, as in passive interception, because they use entrainment to actually project thought, something like what a dolphin would use. The melanin a dolphin would project a sound wave. They use entrainment, and they gradually figure out where your brain waves are, if you will, which of the various levels of brain waves, and which ones also cause you to relax, which is what the rogues use to steal people out of the middle of their...
We're going to follow up a little bit more about J-Rod, and then you really, Dan and Marcy, both of you feel you have a mission in life here that we want to get to and give you some time. We only have an hour show. We could do this for hours, but we would be remiss if we didn't follow up a little bit more about J-Rod. I'm Jerry Pippin, and we have Paula Harris with us as our co-host, and Marcy McDowell, and of course, Dan Burrish is our guest. Don't go away.
In March of 1997, a huge triangular ship appeared over Phoenix. Thousands saw it, and even now, years later, Phoenix is a place of UFO intrigue, sightings, experiences.
This didn't look like anything I've ever seen in my life.
Hear about it on The Jerry Pippin Show.